Welcome to It Just So Happened. I am Richard Pulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 22nd of June. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So, where are we? Well, it was the location of the UK's first pedestrian diagonal crossing. Yes, of course, it's Balham. We're performing this edition of the show in the Wandsworth Arts Fringe, which describes itself as Southwest London's bold and boundary-pushing festival of arts and culture. Now in its 14th year, we're just one of 130 events taking place over 17 days in June within the borough and beyond. And our venue today is the Bedford, a pub venue for live music and comedy on Bedford Hill. The building dates back to the 1830s when it was originally opened as a hotel. The pub won the Publican Music Pub of the Year 2002, the Morning Advertiser Pub of the Year 2004, and the Evening Standard Pub of the Year 2002. You may have noticed it's not won anything in the last 19 years, but we'll move on from that. And we have an audience in the venue with us today, as tens of thousands of people flock to watch comedy at the Bedford every year. So we welcome about 1,000th of that number into this show. So what's brought in such huge numbers? Well, let me introduce the panellists. Please welcome Alex Kitson, Richie Rounds and Arthur Smith. So let's find out a little bit about you briefly. So Alex, you're a multi-award winning stand-up comedian, writer, performer and Devonian. Now, I believe you won the Bath Comedy Festival Award for Best Joke in 2021. Would you like to tell us what the award is called? And are you able to tell us what the joke is?
You've done your research. It's, it sounds more impressive than it is, because I'm also the last winner of the Bath Comedy Award for Best Joke, because the award up until 2021 was sponsored by Love Honey, which are a sex toy company based in Bath. Yes, madam. And he looks surprised. And so it's the Golden Butt Plug Award for Best Joke, yes. which is on my mantelpiece.
Okay.
What was the joke?
What was the joke, though? I couldn't find it anywhere online.
It's a joke about my mum was a teacher, but a joke about another teacher coming up to me and whispering and saying, "Us teachers, we're having an innuendo competition." And later I was like, "Oh, really?" So he goes, "Yeah, I was thinking about entering your mother." And then that's the
I think
that deserves
a clap. Thank you. Brilliant, thank you. Richie, you're a comedian and writer. Your jokes have appeared on Radio 4, 4Extra, BBC Scotland, etc., etc. Regular listeners of the podcast will be familiar with Richie as one of our most frequently returning guests, if not the most frequently returning. I believe your father was from London, is that right?
Yes, my dad was a North London boy. He moved from Stoke Newington down to the Sussex coast, which interestingly is the same journey that Jack the Hat McVitie made in the boot of the crazed car. But my dad did it more successfully.
And Arthur, you're author, poet, stand-up comedian, and the only one of us on the panel with a Wikipedia entry. Which tells me on the Wikipedia entry that you have been at Edinburgh Festival Fringe regular since 1977.
No, I went the first year it happened, 1947, when I was just a baby. Well, no, I hadn't been born. I have been a lot, although I'm not going this year. So that's a bit sad, really. But I'll be in Balham, so that'll be fabulous. I am a resident of Balham, and as I'm sure all of you here know, I am the self-proclaimed mayor, nightmare of Balham. I don't do dates. And maybe later on I'll sing you the song I sang when I proclaimed myself Mayor of Balham at the puddle outside Sainsbury's.
That could be the exit music as people leave.
Always end on a song.
We want to get people out as fast as possible. So now it's straight over to you, Alex, please, for your On the Stage piece. Thank you.
Yes, my On the Stage piece is... what happened on the 22nd of June 1907, where the Charing Cross Euston and Hampstead Railway opened the railway which would eventually become the Northern Line. 22nd of June that opened. 23rd of June, the first ever passenger fell asleep and forgot to get off at Kennington. ended up in Battersea. Plans for railway actually announced before, there were 15 years before, that was in 1891, but in keeping with the future spirit of the Northern Line, construction of the railway was delayed for a decade while funding was sought. I just wish someone had put up like a notice, had the foresight, to when they realised it's going to be delayed for a decade, just to put up a sign saying, one, Northern Line via Charing Cross, 10 years. No one knew what it meant, but I think that'd be funny. They struggled to finance the idea, and they looked for investors for 9 years until American financier Charles Yerkes, who had been lucratively involved in the development of Chicago's tramway system in the 1880s and 90s, saw the opportunity to make similar investments in London. He bought the company for £100,000, which is quite good for that much land in central London. It was also delayed because plans to tunnel under Hampstead Heath were really controversial, and they were authorised despite many local residents who thought they'd do a lot of damage to the ecology of the Heath. But as we all know, regular exploration of holes in Hampstead Heath became quite common about 50 years later. It was not the financial success that might be expected. In the Hampstead Tube's first 12 months of operation, it carried 25 million passengers, just half of the 50 million that had been predicted during the planning of the line. This had the outcome of people actually being able to get a train in the morning and getting a seat, and that couldn't happen. So as a result, in November 1909, the Hampstead Tube, the Piccadilly Tube, and the Bakerloo Tube formed into a single entity, the London Electric Railway, which expanded over the next 17 years, culminating in 1926, when the line combined with the City and South London Railway, which coincided with an expanse all the way south to Morden, via, of course, Balham. This new line ran from Edgware all the way to Morden, and was known as the Morden Edgware Line until about 10 years later, when it was rebranded the Northern Line. And now, the people of Balham are connected to the North London scum. that's my...
It's a double-edged sword, then.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. History's got a lot of, winners and losers. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. Yeah. So I've got a couple of on-the-stay pieces myself in between the panellists. So my first one is about Galileo Galilei, who's renowned for his contributions to astronomy, engineering, physics and mathematics, as well as a cameo appearance in Bohemian Rhapsody. Well, I thought that was funny. The scientific advances he made were during a time of Inquisition, which meant he relied on the protection of powerful patrons, including the Medici and, ironically, the Pope. In 1616, he was forbidden from holding or defending his belief in the Copernican view, but continued to write about the issue and evidence as a means of discussion rather than belief. So my first question to the panel, what was the Copernican view?
Well, that the Earth wasn't the centre of the universe, that we went round the sun didn't go around us.
Yeah, exactly, yes. Heliocentrism. It's a relatively new theory proposed by Nicholas Copernicus that the Earth orbited the sun, not the other way around. The Catholic Church regarded this as heresy, as the scriptures have that the Earth is an immovable centre of the universe. So when Galileo published his book called Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, he was accused of heresy and called to Rome to defend his writings in a trial under the Chief Inquisitor. And so it was on this very day in 1633 that the Church gave its verdict. We pronounce, judge, and declare that you, the said Galileo, have rendered yourself vehemently suspected by this holy office of heresy, that is, of having believed and held a doctrine which is false and contrary to the holy and divine scriptures, that the sun is the centre of the world, and that it does not move from east to west, and that the earth does move and is not the centre of the world. So Galileo had to sign a document which stated, "Oh, kneeling before you, most eminent and reverend Lord Cardinals, Inquisitors General against heretical depravity throughout the entire Christian Commonwealth, having before my eyes and touching with my hands the Holy Gospels, swear that I have always believed, do believe, and by God's help will in the future believe, all that is held, preached, and taught by the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church." So, how was Galileo punished, do you think?
He was... I'm sorry to be a bit of a smart but I did a quick bit of Wikipedia. He was essentially put under house arrest for the rest of his life.
Yeah, that was one of the punishments. The others as well.
Was it space related? Was it?
That would have been nice, wouldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
But no.
He wasn't allowed pizza. Do you know the Earth is really... He proved that as well, that the Earth is flat.
Any thoughts? No. Okay.
I'm not as good at Wikipedia.
I do like the idea of being summoned to Italy to have to defend yourself when people disagree with you.
Yeah.
If you say that on Twitter, you go like, who's a footballer? Like, Wayne Rooney's a bell end, and then you've got to go and defend yourself in front of the Pope.
Case
for Rooney. They probably just agree with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Pick something better. Yeah.
Okay. An era as well when travel anywhere is not going to be as quick and easy. So you can imagine he's just been somewhere, got back home, like, right, got to go to Italy now. I've just got in.
So Galileo was punished by having his book prohibited, which kind of makes sense. He also had to recite the 7 penitential psalms once a week for 3 years.
Oh, God.
He was also condemned to prison, but he actually got away with the house arrest until his death in 1642. Now, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Ferdinando II, wanted to bury Galileo in the main body of the Basilica of Santa Croce, next to the tombs of his father and other ancestors. But the Pope objected, so he's buried in a small room next to a side chapel instead. Now, if you want to see some of Galileo's body parts, he was reburied in the main body of the basilica in 1737, and during the move, 3 fingers and a tooth were removed from his remains. And the fingers are currently exhibited at the Museo Galileo in Florence.
Have they just got one extended pointing towards the Vatican?
I would have thought. So, another question. When did the Vatican finally admit that Galileo's theory was correct?
Have they actually?
They have, yes.
Ooh, but when? Last week? Was it?
Almost.
Yeah. It's going to be depressingly late, isn't it?
I think it was June the 22nd, 1952.
Oh, kind of take an average. It was 1992. I don't know what the date was.
Really?
It was 1992, yeah. Which was actually 17 years after Bohemian Rhapsody came out. Yeah, also late catching up with Einstein, who had already shown that, relatively speaking, there's no such thing as an immovable centre of the universe anyway. Although it might take a lot to persuade either Boris Johnson or Donald Trump that it isn't either of them. I apologise if you now have stuck in your head thunderbolt and lightning. Very, very frightening. Over to you, Richie, please, if you wanted to stay, please. Thank you.
Thank you. So, one thing I've come to realise as a child of the 90s is how much better my parents had it as children of the 60s. They say, if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. But if you remember the 90s, you may have been missold PPI. Ask me why the 60s are better, and I'll say it's because of celebrity encounters. When my dad was a teenager, his regular hangout, the Leighton Baths, had the Beatles playing live, fresh off the release of their first album. Not only that, but you want to know the secret? In Liverpool, my mum was friends with a couple of lads who went on to form The Real Thing, who did the song You to Me Are Everything. My celebrity boast from the 90s is I once saw Peter Andre at the height of his mysterious girl fame, queuing to get into a restaurant. But it's the first of these bands I want to discuss, as on this day in 1981, Mark Chapman pled guilty to the murder of John Lennon. But that's the end, and quite depressing. If we're looking back to yesterday, let's find a beginning instead. So, it just so happened that on this day in 1961, the Beatles made their first record, My Bonnie, as a backing group for Tony Sheridan. The record was produced by Burt Camfrit, who fans of the Bare Naked Ladies, incidentally one of the better things about being a 90s child, will know, had the mad hits. Can you dig it? Camfrit had seen Sheridan and the Beatles working together on stage and realised they had something. So he had them come together in the studio, and thanks to his years of experience, he knew exactly what to do. Highlight the Norfolk boy and keep those less talented Scouse lads in the background. In fact, they barely had any time at all on the record. I say this was the Beatles' first record, but they weren't credited as the Beatles at the time. As the record was going to be released in Germany, Beatles sounded too much like Beatles, which I'm told in German is slang for the word for a part of the male anatomy. I wasn't told exactly which part. I've got suspicions, but I can't put my finger on it right now. There's an apocryphal story that when asked if he thought Ringo was the best drummer in the world, a bandmate said he didn't even think he was the best drummer in the Beatles. Not a true story. But when the record was made, the Beatles, or the Beat Boys as they were credited, in a very literal way had their best drummer. Specifically Pete Best, who recorded with them once, but not a second time. Absent from the record was the first fifth Beatle, an original bad boy Stuart Sutcliffe, a painter who had a huge influence on their visual style, but whose contribution to the Mersey sound was approximately the same as Cilla Black's contribution to the American pop art movement. This was during the band's second stint in Hamburg, a carnival of light and sound, and a hugely important time for them, where they were literally working 8 days a week. If by literally you mean figuratively. It was hard graft, but they did it all for love of music. The musicians in Hamburg described the conditions as being almost like slaves, a bit without the chains. They worked 8 hour stints for very little money and did little but run circles of sleep and work and nothing else. But the raw talent and the 64 hours a week of continuously playing music, sometimes to packed rooms and sometimes for no one, meant they were constantly getting better until they became masters of their art. Within 3 years, the Beatles were suddenly flying up the charts, and the producers of this early record thought it was their birthday, because they had this sudden star hit sitting they already had the rights to. They had this massively marketable recording, and the record was re-released, dropping the Beat Boy name and reverting back to being the Beatles. So apparently, if the money's right, music companies do not mind people seeing their peasels. Sheridan's contribution to what was originally his own record was downplayed with every re-release, and this wasn't even his first experience of a musical near-miss. Someone once went to the Two Eyes coffee bar to invite Sheridan to join some guy's backing band, but they couldn't find him, so they went for this other kid called Hank Marvin instead, and then shortly renamed themselves to The Shadows. But not every near-miss for Sheridan was a bad one. The previous year to the recording, Sheridan went on tour with Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran, who turned him down when he asked if they could give him a lift to the next venue, meaning he avoided a road accident that killed one and badly injured the other. Sheridan remained a musical artist his whole life, sometimes glad of his Beatles connection, sometimes less so, and as for the boys themselves, I don't have to tell you what they went on to do. In fact, they're so ubiquitous. If you listen to this back, you'll see I've seamlessly added 30 Beatles song titles into the script of this talk. So all I've got to do now is share my final thought, which is goodbye, good night, and I need you to help me searching for Sexy Sadie, Bluesface Schubert on the ferry across the Mersey. Thank you.
So when you talk about the Beatles, did you slip in the title Norwegian Wood?
Oh, there are a few song titles that I almost put in a vote. No.
Okay, right, my second On This Day piece. So on this day in 1986, England played a Football World Cup quarter-final match against Argentina in Mexico. Within 5 short minutes, early in the second half, the legendary Argentine footballer and team captain, Diego Maradona, scored both the infamous so-called La Mano de Dios, or Hand of God goal, as well as FIFA's World Cup Goal of the Century. What was the Hand of God goal, and how did it get its name? You weren't even born, were you?
Well, I know this very well, because I was actually alive, obviously. Does anyone else remember it? There's a few here who do. Because I remember I was on a Greek island called Vasiliki, and the game was on live in this bar, but of course it was a different time, so it was like 2 o'clock in the morning or something. Mm. And they had the TV outside this little Greek bar on this warm night. I was sitting there watching it at about 2 in the morning with a few glasses down me. And that goal happened, but of course the commentary was in Greek. So I didn't know that he'd handled it. So I only really ever found that out when I got home. But I always remember the excitement and the joy of sitting outside that cafe on a Greek island on a very warm night watching a very exciting game.
Yeah, imprinted on the memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was in the 51st minute when Maradona began a trademark jinking, weaving run inside the England half before laying the ball off towards Jorge Valdano on the edge of England's 18-yard box with Steve Hodge in close attendance. What looked like a horribly sliced clearance from Hodge, but what he insists was in fact a calculated back pass, was lofted back into the area. As Peter Shilton came off his line to gather, the diminutive Maradona also leapt for the ball, raising his left arm above his head and directing it beyond the goalkeeper and into the unguarded net. As Argentina's players raced to their captain to celebrate, the England players, the ones who saw what had happened, remonstrated with the Tunisian referee and his assistant, who was running the line in the England half, but all to no avail. Where was VAR when he actually wanted it for once? Maradona hinted at what he had done when asked later by journalists how he had scored his first goal. He said, "A little with the head of Maradona and a little with the hand of God." So some quick quiz questions, might be difficult for you, I don't know how much of a football fan you are, but who was the England manager at the time?
Bobby Robson.
Correct. What was the final score?
2-1.
2-1, yes. Who scored England's consolation goal?
Me.
You're in Greece, so I know that's not true.
Gary Lineker.
It was Gary Lineker, brilliant. And how did Argentina progress in the competition after winning in the quarterfinals?
They won in the final, didn't they?
They won in the final.
Germany, was it?
West Germany, as it was then, So 3-2, having beaten Belgium in the semis. It was Argentina's second World Cup win, the third was obviously just last year. And Maradona was later named best player of the tournament because he'd scored 5 goals and assisted 5 more, but who actually won the Golden Boot by scoring the most goals at that World Cup?
Was it God? Was it?
Lineker again.
Yes. Ooh. Yes. So the audience are taking over now. Yes.
Is this going to be another one where the audience get more points than the
I know it's not your specialist subject, I've apologised from the previous show, but it was Gary Lineker. Maradona exchanged his shirt with England defender Steve Hodge, who I mentioned earlier, after the game. After many years of requests to sell the shirt, and a period of 20 years where it was actually on loan to the National Football Museum. Last year, Hodge placed it up for auction with auctioneers Sotheby's, and the shirt sold on the 4th of May last year. Okay, panel, how much do you think it would fetch for Maradona's shirt from that game?
£6.99.
Any advance on £6.99?
£10,000.
£10,000, ooh, that's...
Is that too much? It's too much. You'll know this, Richard.
I'd guess somewhere in the millions. So that's mainly because I accidentally looked at your screen. Yeah.
It actually sold for £7.1 million, and that set a world record for a piece of sports memorabilia.
As Richard just hinted, I'm not a huge football follower, so I don't get a lot of this. But I'm loving the idea of the English players going to the Tunisian ref to explain it and being absolutely stereotypical Brits abroad have refused to learn anything about the language. Oh, we can use this now. Just talk louder, he might get it.
Didn't work, did it? So over to you, Arthur, please, for your On This Day piece. Thank you.
Yes, well, first of all, let me say that I've arrived at an age now where I'm able to persuade young people that I fought in the Second World War. Yeah, as far as my 15-year-old nephew Tom is concerned, in 1942, I was parachuted into occupied France, where I spent 6 months undercover as Jacques Le Boulanger. And this story's gone down so well, his school's doing a project. Now, I do know France, and I do know Paris quite well. I lived there for a year when I was in my early 20s as part of my degree. À partir de maintenant, je ne vais parler qu'en français, afin de vous raconter l'histoire de Vichy. Yes, because I was living in Paris in June the 14th, 1940. And I woke up in the morning, looked out the window, it was all empty, all the French troops had gone. So I went back to bed with a croissant, and then a few hours later I looked out and there's a load of Germans marching up the Champs-Élysées. So obviously, yes, the Germans occupied Paris in June 1914, and what were they going to do? And obviously, the French were defeated But nevertheless, on June the 22nd, that the original French Prime Minister resigned and tried to escape the country. But the new guy was Marcel Pétain, or possibly Pétain. To me, it looks like it should be pronounced Pétain, but I notice people always say Pétain. Comment, anyway. he signed the agreement that led to the Vichy government, which the Vichy government was essentially, the French were allowed to keep about half the country. Obviously, they were a puppet government and were under the influence of the Nazis, who could have invaded at any point. And the Nazis covered the rest of the country. But the idea was, and a lot of French people agreed with it at the time, but first off, they didn't want to have anything to do with the Allies because they hate the fucking British, obviously. They thought, well, okay, we've been invaded, but maybe we can at least have control of this part of the country a bit, which they duly did. So Pétain, it was signed in the same place that the November the 11th, end of the First World War, was signed in this carriage, this train carriage hit that made him do that to humiliate them. And anyway, so the Vichy government, which Vichy is a spa town in the southeast of Paris, that became the new sort of capital. But it wasn't good, because for one thing, they were controlled by the Nazis, and then a lot of anti-Semitism came out. And they also helped transport loads over, I can't remember how many, but thousands of Jews obviously were removed. And at this point, I want to tell you a little story that a French friend of mine I know, who told me this story because she was Jewish and her father was living in France at that time. And he was trying to escape because they were rounding up the Jews and sending them away. And he was just kind of on the run. And he got a train one day, and he arrived at the station. As he got off, there were the Gestapo or the French police, and he knew that they were checking everyone's credentials, and he knew that he didn't have them, and he was Jewish. But what was he going to do? Because if he turned and walked back the other way, they'd have spotted him and chased him. So as he approached the where the ticket inspectors were, there were some people there, and he saw a little boy. And he grabbed him, went, hey, and he picked up the little boy and smiled at him. And then the Germans, the Gestapo said, oh, well, you know, just let him go by. And therefore he managed to, and then he put the little boy down and his dad was okay with it. And in that moment, that thought saved his life. Anyway, I don't want to bang on too much about Vichy. It was fucking awful. And then eventually the Germans, when it was clear they were losing the war, they moved down and took over Vichy. And then, of course, eventually they were all chased out. And Marcel Pétain, who'd been this great hero of the First World War, the Battle of Verdun, was once the Allies had taken over France and the war was lost for the Germans, they took, Pétain was sentenced to death. But de Gaulle, who is now the president, overruled that and said he was house arrest for the rest of his life. And he died in prison at a very old age or under house arrest. And yeah, so that's Vichy France and merci bien, mes braves.
So we come to the second half of the show about Balham. So can you clear one thing up for me? So is Wandsworth the borough, and is Balham part of the borough of Wandsworth? Is that
yes.
How it works?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Although I do proclaim myself mayor of Balham, it's quite easy to do because there is no. There is a mayor of Wandsworth who sort of just, yeah, you know, don't change every year, but it is a bloke who just, he's a little bloke who wears a suit and goes around shaking hands with people. Well, there's a different little bloke in the suit every year.
It's a woman, though, so
what? Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Who is the current mayor that wants it then? Is it you? Yeah, anyway.
So
Balham is essentially, it's a particular area, it's actually in the Doomsday book. Well, it's sort of crossed out and replaced by a chapel. It's under, really, it's a sort of barn or something, and it was just a farm then. I mean, no one lived here then.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it was just a farm or something.
Is this another school project where they, you say, I was when I wrote the Doomsday Book?
Yeah, obviously, I've been around a long time.
Yeah. Right, various topics under Balham. So the first one is called Gateway to the South. Did we establish there's anyone from Balham?
There's a few of us.
So, brilliant. So there's a 1928 Southern Railway poster entitled Gateway to the Continent, showing a map of Europe within a hexagon and red arrows leading from London to destinations in mainland Europe. This seems to have been the inspiration for the radio sketch by Frank Muir and Dennis Norden called Balham, Gateway to the South.
No, Balham.
I'm coming to that. It was broadcast on BBC's third programme, the forerunner to Radio 3, in 1949. The narrator speaks with an American accent of the exotic nature of Balham and its supposed tourist attractions. So I don't know if I can do the accent, but here's an excerpt from it. From Quill's Folly, Balham's famous beauty spot, which stands nearly 10 feet above sea level, the town is spread below us like a fairyland of glittering lights, changing all the time. Green, amber, red, red and amber, and back to green. Which English actor and comedian was the sketch's narrator?
Well, obviously I know this.
As do I. I love that sketch. It's Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers, indeed, yes. With Benny Hill and Michael Benteen providing some of the other voices. The sketch was performed by Sellers on the 1958 Parlophone record, The Best of Sellers. Who produced that record?
I'm just assuming Arthur did everything now. he was telling me all about the war before, I believed every word of it. And
you read his Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Who produced it?
It relates to your topic.
Yes, it does. It was Martin, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was George Martin. Yeah.
Ah, right, yeah.
So the sketch was scored by Ron Goodwin, and that led Alfred Hitchcock to engage him to do the score for his 1972 film Frenzy. So all these connections. And then in 1979, Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees directed a short film released for broadcast in 1981 based on the sketch, with Robbie Coltrane playing multiple roles, including those originally voiced by Sellers. I had a watch of this two nights ago. It's worth a look up on YouTube.
One of my favourite bits, they talk about the traditional industry of Balham, which is the person on the porch carving the holes into the heads of toothbrushes. we carve the holes manually, which means we do it once a year.
It's quite funny though. I mean, I think because it made a bit of a joke out of Balham, which I've always rather appreciated. There's no, you know, Balham could be anywhere grand or glitzy or whatnot. There's no doubt that it was pretty rough when I first moved into Balham. When were you two first?
87.
Yeah, I was 84. Yeah. Do you remember there used to be prostitutes lined along Bedford Hill?
Yeah.
Just outside where we are now.
You changed career then.
there was only one restaurant then, really. You know, it was a much rougher place than now.
Well, the off licences had bars on the windows.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, did you used to break in there?
So yeah, this 1979 film, you can tell. Wow, there's a huge difference between then and now.
I wish I knew the answer to this because I meant to look it up and forgot. Anyone who's like, well, is there actually someone connected to Balham called Quill? Is it Quill, is it, or Quinn?
Quill, yeah.
Quill. Because that name Quill that's in the extra Richard, that name is all throughout that sketch. It's the Quill Church, and the musician is called Quill, and that name is repeated. And I just can't figure out where that name's coming from.
But you're on the panel.
Realistically, being in this chair, I should probably have actually figured that out. Anyone tell me what that is?
Gary Lineker.
Yes, worth a guess, worth a punt, isn't it? In 1990, the Triangle Action Group proposed the erection of a statue of Sellers in the centre of Balham due to the sketch's impact on its tourist trade. When Frank Muir and Dennis Norden heard of this, they wrote a letter to the Evening Standard stating that, for a trifling sum, we would be prepared to go along to the new shopping centre and stand there personally. Right, topic number two. Miss Marple is a fictional character featured in 12 of Agatha Christie's crime novels and 20 of her short stories. What is Miss Marple's first name?
Jane,
yes. And where did Christie get the inspiration for the name Marple?
Was it somewhere in Ballon?
No, it wasn't. No.
Oh.
No. I don't expect you to know this, but you can have a wild guess.
No, I do like a bit of Christy, but I don't know that.
So, do you want that guess, or are you just going to know?
I'm so young.
So it was the name of the railway station in Markle on the Manchester to Sheffield Hope Valley line, at which Agatha Christie was once delayed long enough to have actually noticed the sign. Now, as a joke, I was going to learn the sign, Clanfair, because that's the trains nowadays. Is you stop for so long, you could learn that place name if you wanted to. Who were the first two actresses to play Miss Marple in films?
Oh,
Angela Lansbury.
Margaret Rutherford was
one. Yeah. Margaret Rutherford is one, yes.
Because Joan Hickson was actually in one of the Margaret Rutherford Marples as a housekeeper, I think, if I remember right. Or am I getting mixed up?
So, who predated Margaret Rutherford?
Ooh, Joan Bakewell. Sandy Shaw.
It could be a long list, couldn't it?
Was it Arthur?
It probably was. Yes. Speaking French. No, it was Gracie Fields.
Oh.
Yeah. So in 1956, Fields was the first actress to portray Miss Marple on screen in a US television production of Agatha Christie's A Murder Is Announced. The production featured Jessica Tandy and Roger Moore. Rutherford played Miss Marple in four films directed by George Pollock between 61 and 64. These were successful light comedies, but apparently Christie herself was disappointed with them. Now, specialist question. What else connects Fields and Rutherford?
The Mousetrap. Or, I don't know. John once spent the night in Agatha Christie's house. I mean, she was alive then, obviously. Then. She had this fantastic house down in Devon overlooking the River Dart.
Did someone get murdered?
Yeah.
While he was there, or?
Really disappointing.
I have to say, her not being alive is very on theme.
Yeah, so no, it's not theatre related. It's something to do with Fields and Rutherford, related to where we are.
Oh, she lived in Duquesne Court, whatever.
They were both one time residents of Ballon.
Oh, is Agatha Christie?
No, this is Keeper, Gracie Fields, and Dame Margaret Rutherford. Margaret Rutherford, yeah. Yeah, Margaret Rutherford was born here, and her parents were married in Wandsworth. It's quite a sad story, which I won't go into if you want to look that up later. But Rutherford lived in Balham's Duquesne Court, an Art Deco block of flats on Balham High Road, built in 1937. It was also the location for scenes from the mystery drama Poirot by Agatha Christie. The building features at the opening of the 1991 episode The Plymouth Express. Do you remember that one? In which the character Florence, the daughter of a multimillionaire, lived in the block. The entrance to Duquesne Court is shown in a scene where Florence's husband was visiting her. Which actor played Poirot?
Suchet.
Oh, yeah. I'll give the others a chance, actually.
David Suchet, yeah. Now, what record did the block of flats Duquesne Court hold when it was built?
Is that the one that was like the biggest in Europe?
Yes, yes. It was the largest block of flats in Europe built for private occupation. It contains 676 flats, ranging from studios up to four-bedroom penthouses, and is said to have 6 miles of corridors. Don't know how you prove that. It was a popular place to live for many music hall stars in the 1930s and 40s. The seventh floor of C block had a restaurant with a bar, a ballroom and a band. Resentful locals called it Cocaine Court. The seventh floor has since been converted into flats, which is the way of the world. Now, if Operation Sea Lion, Hitler's plan to invade Great Britain, had been successful, what might have happened to Duquesne Court?
There's a very polite hand up. Do you see that?
Yeah.
It would have been Hitler's headquarters.
Hitler's headquarters, yes, yes.
Yeah, well, this is the theory. I actually did Duquesne Court. Does anyone else here? No, well, you should do. But yes, there's always been this, because I remember as a child when I was about 10, my dad, who'd been in the war and everything, driving by Duquesne Court on our way, so he said, see, that's where Hitler was going to live. which even at the age of 10 seemed a bit unlike. But then they're all, and then I kind of got to learn about this. One of the theories is that from the air it looks like a swastika, although it doesn't. I can sort of see why people would say that. The other one was that during the war, Balon had the ship bombed out of it, but they never touched Duquesne Court, which had just opened, which always seemed a bit suspicious to people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there was a theory that there was some Nazi's wife on the seventh floor was sending radio messages, and then because it was a bit mysterious, because of course when it opened they didn't know the war was coming. And I think a lot of civil service guys used, because it was handy for Whitehall just on the train and everything, Balham's so good for contacts in the rest of London. There was a theory that daughter of Himmler or something, I can't remember. But anyway, this theory certainly took place a long time ago, and it's never really been, no one's ever really got to the bottom of it. I mean, you can imagine, I suppose if Hitler thought, well, I'm going to invade Britain, I'll come up the A23, what the hell, that's a big place, I'll put everyone in there.
Yeah.
I mean, being Germans, they would have had a lot of plans for what was going to happen if they had invaded Britain. They're quite, obviously they had a list of people they were going to kill, didn't they? But, and they were going to move the capital, weren't they, to Manchester or somewhere? Does anyone know this?
Well, so there's two other claims, as well as Duquesne Court. There's Senate House, the HQ of the University of London, also lays claim in a similar fashion. And also a claim for Bridgnorth in the Midlands, which sounds a bit offbeat.
Well,
it kind of makes sense
loved
in a way.
Bridgenorth, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it's
yeah,
well known.
He was always right. He had
well
a pen pal for that.
And the block has a tannoy system as well. So
well, it doesn't anymore, but it used to. Yeah, I moved in, there was a sort of big speaker there, and you could get announcements from the desk at the. If you've ever been there, you should go and have a look. It's a rather lovely sort of 30s Art Deco reception area, and there's 24-hour porterage. So it's quite good if you've got if someone sent you a parcel. And just go and pick it up rather than go down the post office. Anyway, I'm going on a bit.
That's what's advantages. The last bit on this section, incidentally, you're not going to know this either, but what was Dame Margaret Rutherford's connection to Labour politician Tony Benn?
They were both part of the Balham group or something.
Ooh, nice one. No. Well, they might have been, but that's not the answer I've got. So they're related. They were first cousins once removed. So Margaret Rutherford related to Tony Benn. So, do you know who Tony Benn is?
Yeah.
Just thought about checking that.
On my fact a while ago about Joan Hickson being in the Margaret Rutherford Marple, David Suchet, we just mentioned, was in one of the Peace of the Eastern Marples, Poirot's as well. So this crossbreeding of Poirot's and Marple's in different. That's a phrase I didn't think I'd be saying.
Right. So, who was the writer for the popular TV sitcom Only Fools and Horses?
John Sullivan.
Yes. So he was born in Ballon, John Sullivan. His father was a plumber and mother an occasional charwoman. And it was here where he observed the sort of market trader that would later appear in Only Fools and Horses. He failed his 11 plus and left school with no qualifications, so it just goes to prove that isn't everything. Sullivan's first paid employment was as a messenger boy in Reuters. He then worked in the second-hand car trade, in a brewery, as a window cleaner and a carpet layer in the House of Commons. He got a job in the BBC props department and ended up writing sketches for the Two Ronnies and for Dave Allen. He then wrote scripts for successful sitcoms Citizen Smith and Only Fools and Horses. The latter is frequently voted Britain's best-loved sitcom and holds the record for the highest UK audience of a sitcom episode of 24.3 million viewers. Panel, can you complete the phrase? Only fools and horses
work.
Yeah, work for a living.
I'll give you that. I'm just taking it from the theme song. That one just stops at work.
So you do whatever you have to do to avoid hard work.
I'm loving this. Got a job at the BBC in the props department and then ended up writing his own sitcoms. It does not work like that now.
Where did Del Boy's phrase, lovely jubbly, come from?
was Chumley was Jubilee, wasn't it?
Oh, right. No,
so
a different take on it, yeah.
When it was the Jubilee, someone said lovely.
Okay, well, any other thoughts?
I don't know if you had fun with those cheap lollies you can get from the pound shop.
You are so close.
That was just supposed to be a stupid reference.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cheap lollies, so his mouth is... Was he doing
the
cocaine?
The cheap lollies are called jubblies.
Was he, what?
The cheap lollies are called jubblies.
Ah!
Yeah, so a 1950s or 60s advert for an orange-flavoured drink, the Jubbly, made by Calypso. Is that what you think of?
It might be the same Jubbly, yeah.
Which came in a triangular 3D carton.
That is exactly the one, in
fact. Could be frozen and eaten as a nice lolly. So the slogan was Jubbly... No, it was Lovely Jubbly. And it's unclear whether John Sullivan deliberately made Del Boy say the phrase the wrong way around. I'm not sure. So that's an alternative theory on the Jubbly bit. Denzel's wife, Corinne, only appeared in a single episode of the sitcom. It's quite sad, actually. She was played by Eva Motley, who died aged 31 in 1985. Eva had a 2-year relationship with David Bowie. And another random thing, her cousin Mia Motley was elected the Prime Minister of Barbados in 2018. Strange, all these connections.
Hey, talking about connections, you mentioned Mickey Dolenz earlier on.
Yes.
You know, David Bowie is why... His bandmate, Dave Jones, is why David Bowie was David Bowie. Because David Bowie was David Jones, but one of the monkeys already had the name, so he had to come up with the stage name. Random fact, but that's what we're here for.
And he was eating ice cream called a Bowie.
Yes. Okay, next person relates to Balham. What is the stage name of Balham-born musician Raymond Ian Burns?
That would be Captain Sensible.
Yay. And what group does he play with, even now?
The Damned.
The Damned, yes. So they formed in 1976. Which is a year before I've got you first going to Edinburgh, but that's not true. Originally playing on bass and then on guitar. Burns adopted his ironic stage name, Captain Sensible, because he described himself as a debauched maniac who had fun regardless of the consequences. What was his 1982 number one hit called?
Happy Talk.
Okay. Because you do pub quizzes, don't you?
I do something. Well, also, my friend is in the audience today. Was chatting before and has actually met Captain Sensible.
Oh, okay.
So I was briefed on
frequently.
That's it. Frequently. Interesting. So Happy Talk was a Rodgers and Hammerstein song from which musical?
I'm thinking. Is it South Pacific or wrong?
Yeah.
Oklahoma. South Pacific.
Yay, well done. Captain Sensible's recording of the Snooker song from Mike Batt's musical The Hunting of the Snark was used as a theme music for the BBC game show Big Break, broadcast between 1991 and 2002. Question: what political party did Sensible form and launch in 2006?
Did what?
So he formed
Captain
and
Sensible,
launched.
Right.
Yeah, formed and launched a political party. Is anyone a member?
The Conservative Party.
Yeah. Well, are they called Captain Sensible? No, I don't know.
No, I've forgotten this one, unfortunately.
So it was, I don't expect you to know, it was the Blah Party. So he said, we believe that voting is an important part of the democratic process and we want the Blah Party to be part of protest. Sorry, a party of protest. A channel through which the people of the UK can vent their dissatisfaction at nonsensical everyday things and protest against the government and the current crop of political parties. The party was largely modelled on the principle of direct democracy, with suggestions being made by anyone on the party website. These suggestions would then be voted on by the membership, resulting in a rolling manifesto. Initial policies included stopping chav culture and the idolisation of airhead celebrities like the Beckhams and Paris Hilton, alongside more serious policies of opposing the Iraq War and ID cards, instead spending money on public transport, hospitals and renewable energy. I think the party should still be around. Question, with which company did the party enter a sponsorship deal, do you think?
Well, isn't someone who sponsored the party?
Yes, some company. company might have done that.
Wix.
Yeah,
why not Wix?
No, I haven't heard this.
Just have a guess.
Is it 118, 118?
Yeah, why not? Do they still exist?
I've got no idea. I am.
Thinking. No. Yes.
No, not that.
Well, it was with Seabrook Crisps. The party logo was printed on their packets along with details on joining for free.
Oh, you can't get Seabrook anymore.
Strange, isn't it? How well did the party do in elections, given that no one's heard of them?
Badly.
Yeah.
Yes. They got 56 votes.
That's pretty close, actually. Yeah. So the first candidate was Carl Finlan, who stood in the 2007 local elections in Thornton and Allerton ward in Bradford, and he got 69 votes. And then Deputy Leader Melody Staniford stood in the Home Valley North ward of Kirklees as Boney Moroney in 2008, and she gained 38 votes.
That's more than Lawrence Fox.
And then the party deregistered from the Register of Political Parties in 2008. What a shame. Bring them back. Right, this is my last topic. In March 2014, the BBC reported that the world's first intelligent pedestrian crossings were being trialled at Balham and Tooting Bec tube stations. What made the pedestrian crossings intelligent?
Well, these are the ones that wouldn't go back green if there were people on the crossing.
Yes.
Down the road there by the tube.
Yeah. Do they still function intelligently?
Yeah. Yeah, they're great. Yeah. The little green man comes on, always slightly after the other little green man on the other side. But he comes on, I think it's a he, is he? Anyway, the green man comes on, or green person, the green whatever it is they are.
An alien.
Yeah, and then off you go, and it counts down 15, 14, 13. If you get there when it's 3, you think, should I take a chance? Yeah. And it is. It's one of Balham's greatest achievements. Yeah. The world's first.
And do you still have this diagonal crossing?
Yeah,
still there.
Amazing. So what I've got here is the pedestrian crossing could detect how many people were crossing the road, or waiting to cross the road. And the device used technology that adjusted traffic signal timings, giving people longer to cross if required. Mm-hmm. TfL said the new mechanisms would make it safer and easier for people to use the crossings, and would make traffic signals more intelligent.
So it takes a look at you and goes, they can't make it in 15. That's quite exciting. If it flashes up with like 40,
Do you remember when they used to beep? Traffic lights. I used to beep, blind people end up dying because it bleeps. Anyway, that joke doesn't work.
That was a not 9 o'clock news sketch, wasn't it? Where the digital watch went off at the crossing and then blind man stopped.
I once, many years ago, was having a conversation with a friend of mine who was a bit of a know-it-all, and he loved facts about many facts about these pedestrian crossings, and he talked about the beeping they have so blind people know when to cross. I said, yeah. I said, well, what do they do for deaf people? And he went, I know that. Underneath, there's like a little nub that feels like a toothpaste tube head, and then when it's ready, it spins. I thought, yeah, but if they're deaf, they can just see the light.
So at the time, the Mayor of London was Boris Johnson, and he said he was delighted that the capital would be the first city in the world to trial the equipment. I said it something like that. The pedestrian.
Boris Johnson
I don't do impressions. I did that off the top of my head, so I'm quite pleased doing it myself. I don't know what everyone else thought.
It's an interesting choice of words when you talk about pedestrian crossings to say you're delighted.
I don't know how much to say about this. This is incredibly boring stuff. The pedestrian split cycle offset optimization technique, or SCOOT for short. This is a quote. Will use cameras that can detect how many people are standing on the pavement and then extend the green crossing light to allow more people to cross the road. TfL is also developing call cancel mechanisms that will stop the green man signal when the person who has pushed the button has already crossed or walked away. How amazing is that? Technology!
Yeah.
And so if we want a truly intelligent traffic light, which as it goes green will beep up on the phone to the person who's staring at it saying, no, look up and cross.
you could sell that, I'm sure. So any more on this?
Yeah, I've learned a lot.
It's broad boulevards and it's pulsating nightlife. Balham is like a cross between Paris and Rio de Janeiro. That's like a closing note.
Oh, in that case,
Clapham is twinned with a mud flat inside.
In that case, I would just like to thank the panel. Thank you. We had Alex Kitson, Richie Rant, and Arthur Smith. Thank you. I'd like to thank the Wandsworth Art Fringe and the Bedford for hosting us today, and obviously to our guests as well. Our next show will be at the Assembly Rooms in Nerdlow, if you happen to be passing by on Saturday.
No one's ever passed by,
no. No, you don't do that sort of thing, do you? It's part of the Ludlow Fringe Festival on Saturday at 7 o'clock in the evening. So I've got one final On This Day piece before we close. On this day in 2008, American comedian and actor George Carlin died of heart failure at the age of 71, just one week after his last performance in Paradise, Nevada. So here are five quotes from him with which to end the show. Number one, not only do I not know what's going on, I wouldn't know what to do about it if I did. Number two, when you're born, you get a ticket to the freak show. When you're born in America, you get a front row seat. Number three, and I love this one, have you ever noticed that anyone driving slower than you is an idiot? And anyone going faster than you is a maniac? Number four, I went to a bookstore and asked the saleswoman, where's the self-help section? She said, if she told me, it would defeat the purpose. And the final one. No, hold back. And the final one. Some people see things that are and ask, why? Some people dream of things that never were and ask, why not? Some people have to go to work and don't have time for all of that. And with that, thank you and goodbye. So I think you're going to sing us a song, as people do.
Oh, yeah. Do you want the... how much is swearing allowed in...
Fuck it.
I am the mayor of Balham, oh yes, I fucking am. I am the mayor of Balham, I fucking am. Wait! Come on, let's all sing it. Come on, let's all sing it.